This is February 27, meeting of the House Water Committee, and at this point we'll call it to order. The first item on our agenda is the introduction of a LC Draft 3303 as a committee bill. As always, for the record, you're voting for the introduction of this as a committee bill. In no way states your position or implies your position as to the merits or lack of merits of the bill, and certainly in no way binds you, to voting yes for it or no for it at a later period of time. So the chair would move that we introduce LC 3303 as a committee bill. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. At this point, we'll open a work session on House Bill 2366. And Pete, would you update us as to where we're at with this?
House Bill 2366 was heard last Tuesday, the 24th, and 25th. And this bill directs Water Resources Department to prepare an inventory of potential surface water storage sites in the state, appropriates money, and declares emergency effective on passage.
Referral?
Yeah, it is referred to House Ways and Means, or Ways and Means, a subsequent referral.
Okay. You need a motion?
I do.
I would move House Bill 2366 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cruz moves House Bill 2366 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I would like to call on the Water Resources Department because I have some questions and clarifications.
I see we're fortunate. Adam is here this morning, and he has all the answers.
Good morning, Chair Jensen. Adam Sussman with the Water Resources Department, for the record.
Thank you.
Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Don't ask me why, but about 10 o'clock last night, I was reading through this information again and came up with some questions that I didn't ask during the public hearing that I'd like to get clarification on. One is, it has to do with looking at the focus of this inventory. I know this is just the measure summary, but in the last paragraph of the measure summary, it talks about how the bill... part of the task force recommendation is to look at further development of multi-source long-term water supply strategy that combines surface water, groundwater storage, and water conservation efficiency. And I know we have the companion bill with the numbers looking at conservation. Under Section 1 of House Bill 2366, however, the inventory only addresses potential surface water storage sites. And I guess I would like to ask you, does that mean you're not going to look at groundwater and ASR sites potential? Because to me it's all connected, and if we're going to look at truly finding additional water supplies, we need to look at all options. So I guess I have a question about why that wasn't included in the bill.
Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, I think you're accurate in that the task force, the recommendations they made, have this sort of companion look at water efficiency, water conservation as an element of water supply. This bill, this particular bill, was strictly focused on doing an inventory of surface water storage sites, and we felt like with the appropriation in this bill and the resources that would provide, that would be adequate to do this sort of very focused type of inventory. The department has done some work on identifying sites for aquifer storage and recovery through the Senate Bill 93 Task Force. We actually developed a brochure that lays out the process and how it works and identified some areas for potential. But that's a much bigger task. I think the task that you're asking to not only identify surface storage sites, but storage sites for groundwater is sort of another level of resources that would be required. So the task force in this case, I think, was trying to be very focused and look at only surface water storage sites in this instance. And I think a distinction between this inventory and the inventory you're requesting is this is going to be based on existing information. And while there may be some existing information on the possibility of aquifer storage and recovery, that exercise would be more of creating a wheel rather than going out and collecting what's already been created.
Okay.
Follow up.
And for the record, I do believe we should be looking at all supply sources, because especially in this day and age when it's harder and harder to find, especially, you know, I'm hoping we're looking at both the on-stream storage and off-stream, but I think, as we all know, it's much harder to cite the on-stream storage, and I know I've worked on a couple of those projects myself, and, you know, so that's why I guess I would really encourage you, and I'm not going to suggest an amendment, but I do believe that in this day and age, you know, we need to be looking more at innovative approaches like ASR versus storage facilities, you know, surface water storage facilities. But I do have a follow-up regarding looking at prioritization. And when I read this bill, the way I read it is just saying you're going to do an inventory.
Right.
So is there going to be follow-up work with prioritization? And if so, how did the task force develop criteria? In other words, is this going to be just a list, or is it actually going to be a ranking by the department that says, here's a list of all the sites, and we've prioritized them based on, you know, environmental permitting cost factors?
Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, the task force did not develop any sort of criteria for ranking them, but I think it's the department's belief that what we want to do with this information is make it as useful as possible. So to the extent that the information is out there that there's a fishery concern or there's a public health and safety concern because there's housing downstream, we would put all of that information into the inventory. But again, it really, I think, depends on the resources that we have to conduct this. And I think from our hearing we understood that the resources that we get to do this inventory will likely be ones that we find through some other funding mechanism other than the general fund. So the short answer is, to the extent that we can make it as useful as possible, we will do that.
Okay.
The chair would like to comment on that too, and I think Adam is correct in relationship to the resources. The chair believes that this is an important first step, perhaps only first step, and maybe a baby step, in the whole process. But the chair would hate to have seen this bill go down because we encumbered it with too many other things that would have raised the resources necessary to enact it impossible, and therefore get lost in that. And I think in relationship to the aquifer recharge issues, at least as I understand it, there are some other complications, significant complications with that. That the I don't believe the task force was really ready to make great recommendations on that. The task force, I believe, recognizes the limitations of what we have done here. But just because it's limited does not mean the task force felt we shouldn't be pursuing it at this time.
Okay.
But your questions and your observations are well noted for the record, so that future legislation and future work does not ignore those as we pursue this extremely important topic of conserving and storing water. And from a paper I was reading last night that projects by the end of the end of this century, we will be looking at a population of in the Pacific Northwest of somewhere in excess of 50 million. That's up from existing 14 million. And 50 million plus people is going to take a lot more water than the existing 14 million that we have. So clearly, if we have a water problem today, we will have one with us for a long time. Yeah.
Thank you. And that leads me into what I wanted to comment, I guess, more than with the rankings and the importance of the environmental concerns, which I'm as worried about and concerned about as Representative Dingfelder. When and if we ever do start ranking stuff, I would need and use, potential need and use would be, otherwise why would we be doing this? But I just, especially where they're at, you know, where if we don't know there's a resource and you're looking for, you have a business that has great water needs, it'd be great to just go to that reference and say, well, here's a place with the workforce right next to it and an opportunity. So need and use would be right up there too.
I think the issue of a ranking, you know, as far as a priority, it would probably have great merit if we were going to provide the Water Resource Department with the necessary resources to build and construct these. But my sense is that most of these facilities will probably be built and constructed by the people that are on the land. That is, at least in a major part, the farmers and ranchers around the state will be ones that will be most active with it. And I'd hate to have a number two ranking not take place if a group of farmers were willing to step up and do it, sort of thing.
Mr. Chair, can I just make one more comment for the record? I would be remiss if I didn't add this. Since I did my master's thesis on water conservation, I'm sure my graduate advisor is watching somewhere. Recognizing, I think it's really important also in this process, and I think this is already recognized in the statute, but that conservation is the least expensive water supply source that we have. In other words, recognizing and balancing, you know, what we're doing, and I know there's the companion bill looking at some conservation tools to promote conservation, but certainly I hope that will be included in when we get to prioritization down the road and the cost-benefit analysis of these proposed sites. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Any other discussions? Representative Krupp, we are about to vote on House Bill 2366. Do you have any comments or discussions?
No, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay. Hearing no further discussions or comments, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Having received the constitutional majority to your passage and referral, House Bill 2366 is referred to the Committee on Ways and Means with a do-pass recommendation. At this point, we'd open a public hearing on House Bill 2210. We have
House Bill 2210 increases the amount person contracting or offering services to contract for construction, alteration, abandonment, or conservation of wells must have a surety bond or irrevocable letter of credit. Increases the amount applicant for permit to construct, alter, abandon, or convert well must have in bond or irrevocable letter of credit.
Okay. We have two people currently signed up for this. We'll start with Adam Sussman from the Water Resources Department.
Good
Good morning, Chair Jensen, members of the committee. Again, Adam Sussman with the Water Resources Department. I'm the Senior Policy Coordinator and Legislative Coordinator. And thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2210. This was a measure that was developed by the Water Resources Department. And what this bill does is amends ORS 537-753 to increase the bonding level of licensed well contractors from $4,000 to $10,000, and for landowners constructing their own well from $2,000 to $5,000. Since 1955, as part of the Groundwater Act, the department has regulated the and licensed well constructors in the state of Oregon. And since 1961, those drilling contractors have been required to post a bond, like other constructors have to do. The bond is to cover the repair and abandonment of a misconstructed well. And under current law, those well contractors are required to carry a $4,000 bond, and that bond is designed to carry to cover wells that have been constructed for the last 3 years. However, you can imagine with the current cost of well construction, there are many cases where a $4,000 bond is not sufficient, and in that case, the landowner would have to bear the financial burden of having that well repaired or abandoned. And in cases where there's more than one well involved, of course, the first person that goes after the bond would make a claim on it, and that would pretty much be the bond. Now, over the past few years, the department has run across several instances where there was an issue and the bond was not sufficient. And recently, there was a well constructed, just to give you an example, that was commingling aquifers, which, when you do this, it causes could potentially cause two problems. One is it could lead to contamination of the aquifer. And the more serious problem is it can actually drain the pressure out of an aquifer to the detriment of water users using that aquifer. In that instance, the repair of that well was estimated to be $8,000. So just to give you an example of how the repair and the bond match up. We do have over 300 licensed and bonded well contractors in the state, and they're pretty active, and they can drill as many as 30 to 40 wells in a year. This bond was last adjusted in 1985. A $4,000 bond for a driller cost approximately $120 per year. And increasing the bond to $10,000, as this bill proposes, would raise that an additional $150 per year. Now, in addition to the well contractors that are out there, since 1971, landowners that are constructing their own well under a permit from the state are also required to carry a bond. And the purpose of this bond would be to protect, of course, the resource as well as adjoining property owners and other third parties, such as maybe the lending institution that has title to the property. Under current law, a landowner operating under a permit needs to carry a $2,000 bond. And we get about 10 to 12 of these landowner permit requests each year. This bond has never been adjusted since 71. The cost of a $2,000 bond is about $100, and raising it, as we're proposing, to $5,000 would increase the cost about an additional $50. An increase in the bond, both for the well contractors and the landowners, what it does is it better reflects the cost of well repair and abandonment and provides greater resource protection and protection for those that are affected in the case of a misconstructed well. We've shared this concept with the well constructor stakeholder groups, and there appears to be general support. We're not aware of any opposition to the bill by landowners that are contemplating the construction of their own well, and the department urges your favorable consideration of House Bill 2210.
Any questions for Adam?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
Thank you. Thank you, Adam. You indicated just now that you weren't aware of any opposition from well
drillers or landowners in regard to the proposed increase. Have you solicited that type of input from them on the proposed increase?
Yes. Chair Jensen, Representative Flores, we have worked with the Oregon Groundwater Association, which is the association that represents the well construction contractors, and I believe they're here today to testify, and it's my understanding that they're not opposed to the increase. In terms of landowner individuals, that's a harder group because they're not organized, so to the extent that we've made this information available through appearances before our Water Resources Commission, appearances before the Groundwater Advisory Committee, which advises our Water Resources Commission. We've done, I think, what we can to kind of get the word out on the street that we're proposing to make this change.
Thank you.
Yes.
Other questions? None of the fees for the increase would be going to the department. They would be going to the bond. Or is the department carrying the bond?
Chair Jensen, you're correct that it would go to the insurance company, the surety bond company.
So it is fundamentally, as far as we are concerned here, revenue neutral issue. It is not, however, revenue neutral as far as the well drillers are concerned.
That's correct.
Okay. I guess that's it then, Adam, and our... Let's see. I know. The next one we have testifying will be Jerry Schmidt. The Oregon Groundwater Association.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jerry Schmidt. I am here today representing the Oregon Groundwater Association. I don't have a lot of comments. I just wanted to appear before you in case any of the committee members had questions. This is essentially the same concept put forth in the department's budget in 99. The issue there, the only difference in that particular piece of legislation that they were pushing forward in their budget was they were raising the homeowner's fee from $25 to $75 to match the start card fees. The concept, when we discussed it in the stakeholders group about the issue, we have no problem about raising the bond because the bond's too low, and we need to raise the bond to give the department a better tool to monitor those cases where members of the industry make a mistake. When it comes to the landowner issue, the concern was that unlike other issues such as a homeowner installing a light switch, a person ought to be able to do that. However, when you drill a well, the issue is that they have to go to the department, and it takes a lot of department time and personnel, and it takes it away from other things that the department could be doing. So, and it's essential the department monitor this, because this is essential to all Oregonians, because if somebody misconstructs a well, we could possibly contaminate an entire aquifer. So they need to be involved. The problem is this $25 doesn't cover the department's time. $75 doesn't cover the department time. We didn't resolve the issue of how we'd go about doing that, so that's the only thing that was left on the table that we didn't know how to address. The fact that a homeowner trying to construct something as complicated as a well, how we would go about doing that, and how the department would recoup its costs in monitoring those situations. Okay. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm open to any questions if anybody has any questions.
Any questions for Representative Dingfelder?
Thank you. Regarding the fee increase, so I'm assuming that was not, and I don't have the Water Resources fee bill in front of me, but I'm assuming that was not then part of the Water Resources fee bill recommendation, is to increase the groundwater fees.
Representative Dingfelder, Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Sussman will best answer that.
Thank you, Adam.
Sure. Chair Jensen, Representative Dingfelder, that's correct.
For the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Adam Sussman, Water Resources, for the record. Representative Dingfelder, the increase in the landowner permit, which is currently $25, is not part of the department's fee increase. But to address some of the concerns that Jerry has raised in terms of how the department interacts with landowners, we have made some significant changes over the last year through rulemaking. Firstly, in the past, we did not charge a landowner a $75 start card fee. We've adjusted that through our rulemaking. We clearly had the statutory authority to do that, so now we have the $75 start card fee that all other well owners would have. We've also made some changes in our rules that now require landowners to come to the department and provide kind of a preliminary plan for how they're going to construct the well. This really gives the department and the landowner an opportunity to get together and talk about how this well is going to be constructed before it actually starts. And the third significant change we made is now that once a landowner receives a permit, that permit is only good for 6 months. So we don't have someone stringing the construction of a well on for years and years at the risk of both their neighbors and the resource.
Okay. I have a follow-up.
Follow-up.
And this is for Mr. Is it Sussman, right? Is that for? I mean,
Schmidt.
No, I'm sorry. What's your last name again?
Schmidt.
Schmidt, okay. Mr. Schmidt. So you still feel, though, that the permit fee, this individual permit fee, is not enough to cover the cost for individual? I guess I'm just trying to figure out what your recommendations are that you think you feel comfortable with to cover the costs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder, I brought the issue up just so that the committee was aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I can't solve the issue. I can tell you that the fees are way too low in order to cover the personnel and the time for the department to do their job because of the fact that they have to handhold these folks through the process. It's like going into your house and installing a three-phase electrical panel. I mean, it is very complicated. It takes a lot of expertise. So to the department's defense, they have to handhold these folks through the process. The only way to recoup that cost would be to, you could increase the bond, but that doesn't help. I mean, because it doesn't recoup the time the department's personnel has to spend on the issue. The only way to recoup that cost would be to raise the fee. And I don't know if that's a popular thing to do, to come in and raise a landowner's fee to some portion of mm-hmm. the cost of the department. And that's why I raise it to you, just to let you know that is an issue.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And at this point, then, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2210, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2516.
House Bill 2516 directs the State Department of Fish and Wildlife to develop and implement a plan to control and reduce pinniped predation of salmonids in state waters of the state, excuse me, requires department to submit the plan to appropriate interim committees of the 72nd Legislative Assembly and to the United States Secretary of Commerce for review, declares emergency, and is effective upon passage.
Okay, with that, we have several people signed up. We have start off with Robin Brown from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Good morning, Mr. Brown. How are you today?
Good morning, Chair Jensen. Just fine. Thank you very much. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Robin Brown. I'm employed by the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and I lead our agency's research and administrative activities with respect to involving the various species of marine mammals that occur in Oregon. I'm pleased to meet with you this morning and provide the department's comments on House Bill 2516, which is, as just stated, would direct the department to develop and implement a wildlife management plan to control and reduce seal and sea lion predation on salmonids in state waters. We recognize in the bill that it focuses on the use of non-lethal tools to accomplish that objective and would require the inclusion of all other feasible and prudent management alternatives. The bill by April 1st of 2004 would require us to have that plan developed, and prior to implementation, the bill would be made available to the appropriate committees of the 72nd Legislative Assembly and to the Secretary of Commerce, U.S. Secretary of Commerce, under the authorities of the Marine Mammal Protection Act. A few points for our clarification, unless otherwise instructed. The department has interpreted the term pinnipeds in the bill to refer primarily, but and perhaps exclusively, to California sea lions and Pacific harbor seals. Salmonids to refer particularly to, but perhaps not exclusively, to state or federally listed stocks of salmon and steelhead and other salmonids. And waters of the state to refer primarily, at least, to Oregon estuaries and river systems. Our comments to the committee on the bill are the following. The Marine Mammal Protection Act in Section 109 does provide for a transfer of management authority for these species from the federal government back to the states, including the species that we're discussing here today. In order to request transfer of management, the law requires that the states determine that these populations are within their optimum sustainable population range, or what we commonly refer to as the species is at OSP. And until recently, we've been unable to make this determination for any marine mammal species, but at this time we do have population trend data that would support an OSP determination for harbor seals in Oregon and probably along the entire West Coast. So at this time, harbor seals would be the only species for which we have we can meet the threshold of determining that a species is within OSP. So it would be the only species for which transfer of management authority under the law could be requested. It's worth noting, I think we noted it when I met with you previously a couple of weeks ago, that we could expect significant legal and scientific challenge to our determination of that harbor seals may be within their OSP range, just something that we need to be aware of going in. Recently, with the support of the Oregon Legislature through our department's budget and with additional funding from the National Marine Fisheries Service, we've been able to begin to examine and evaluate interactions between seals and salmonids at various locations in the state. But the development of a defensible statewide plan would require quite a bit more work on our part, groundwork, in order to identify specific problem areas where seals may be impacting in a negative way salmonid stocks or their recovery, and then to develop options for reducing and controlling that predation. And we say this to suggest that the timeline for preparing and submitting the plan, as outlined under HB 2516, may be somewhat optimistic from our perspective. The department agrees that non-lethal means for reducing predation is the most desirable option for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is that some level of public concern could be expected if other lethal means were a primary management tool proposed. And unfortunately, to date, we know of no highly effective long-term non-lethal deterrence that could be used with consistent success. This may be one of the areas that the department and others would need to invest some time and resources in to develop. And myself, being familiar with the various options and approaches to this question that have been developed and tested so far, I think I can say the task would not be a simple one, and we could require an extended period of development and testing before a highly successful non-lethal deterrent becomes available for use in management. And of course, we all know the level of social and political controversy that surrounds the issues of predators and their prey. And from our experience with a variety of species and situations throughout the state and across the country, I can attest to my belief that few of those controversies can match what we might expect to encounter with the management of these adorable, big-eyed, furry fish eaters that we're all very familiar with. And it's not to say that that's a reason to shy away from the issue if it needs to be addressed, but it is something we need to be very well aware of as we move forward. I've mentioned to you before in the past that the National Marine Fisheries Service report to Congress, the U.S. Congress, that was submitted in 1999, that proposed a more limited, perhaps doable management approach to addressing these kinds of problems we're talking about here between seals and sea lions and threatened and endangered salmonids. And as I mentioned to you, those of us that were involved in that process and helping develop that report are disappointed that Congress has not taken up those recommendations under serious consideration. Of course, they have a lot that they're dealing with there as well. Probably something that goes without saying in the current budget situation we're all struggling with is that the department recognizes that this bill, 2516, would require the creation of a largely new wildlife management program within the department, including staff and resources that would be needed to address the issues and mandates given the agency under the bill. Finally, we'd like you to know that the department fully intends to continue to monitor these populations, seals and sea lions, and to continue as we can to investigate their potential impacts on the recovery of threatened and endangered salmonid stocks in Oregon, particularly while the National Marine Fisheries Service is continuing to provide funding to the state specifically for that purpose. We appreciate the opportunity to share these comments with you, and I would be happy to try to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Kurtz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If, with Chair's permission, I have a series of questions.
That's fine.
Okay. Would it, and clearly understanding that the date of implementation may be problematic, but the definitions that you are assuming, would it be better if they were explicit in the bill? I mean, you know, I mean, because clearly, for example, you know, the Stellar Sea Lion is covered under the Endangered Species Act, so it really can't be included in here. So would it be better if the language was explicit as to species?
Chair Jensen, Representative Cruz, I think for clarification and to avoid misinterpretation by others that are going to look at this bill, I guess I would suggest that's a good idea. And at this point, if you agree with our contention that we really only have the population data to support a request for management of harbor seals, it might be wise to just go ahead and be that specific in the bill.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm not wanting to be that specific necessarily because I'm trying to maybe approach this from a different dynamic because, you know, based on your work with National Marine Fisheries Service and, you know, knowing that the federal government does things in a bigger and grander way than state government does, and we tend to, if we have a problem that we come at loggerheads with, we will study it and study it and study it and then do nothing. And my sense with the feds on trying to deal with this conundrum between Marine Mammal Protection and Endangered Species Act, they're going to study it out into infinity and probably come up with nothing. You know, this gets, for me, this gets back to a basic question that I have asked for a long time is, what do you do when you have an endangered animal eating an endangered plant? And clearly that's the situation we have here. So, you know, I guess my thought was we need to make a petition to not necessarily wait for optimum populations, but deal with impact on salmonids under ESA and see if we can get exceptions from that, from a different perspective than what the Marine Mammal Protection Act puts in play. Because clearly, I'm not sure when you reach optimum population, yeah, there's really anything you can do. They're still protected under the Act. So, So, I mean, that's kind of, we had this conversation 2 years ago, and I tend to be rather persistent in some things that I think are avenues that need to be explored. And also, clearly, Mr. Chair, due to, I mean, this, I don't know if this bill has a subsequent referral, but it clearly needs one, to put this in the department's book of business. It needs to go to Ways and Means. So, I don't even know if there was a question in there.
Chair Jensen, Representative Cruz, I think I understand your general point there, and as far as being specific about this, the actual species that are mentioned in the bill, it's certainly your choice to include others for which at this point in time we may not have the population data needed, but we may, in a few years out into the future, have such information. I can't answer that question right now.
But I guess the point on that, if unless the language is specific, the department would assume we are talking about any pinniped species that reaches optimum population. And so, if we wanted to, ask the department. To have a conversation with the Federal Department of Commerce on other species, we would need to be specific in the language.
Chair Jensen, Representative Cruz, I would think so, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Other questions? I might suggest to the department that they could conceivably use the same mechanism that Washington did in the Puget Sound and bring a pod of orcas in to, they seem to have made a dent in about a third, from what I understand, up in the Puget Sound, and that would reduce the take as far as salmon are concerned.
Mr. Chair, I have a suggestion.
Yes.
That we invite Kiko back to help us.
You should never have sent that thing away.
To deal with the problem.
Chair Jensen and committee members, I always caution that there are two types of killer whales, those that love to eat seals and sea lions and those that live almost exclusively on salmon.
Yeah, that is true.
I'd also share with you that the state of Washington, who is also doing investigations into seal and sea lion depredation on salmonids, as are we in the state of California. One of their primary study areas was the Hood Canal that they've been looking at for several years, which is the location where these whales have come in and now completely disrupted 2 years of their study.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Robin, the National Marine Fisheries report that you alluded to, I think it was in 1999?
Yes.
Is it being used as a basis by most of the players in this circumstance as the proper direction, or is there great dissent?
Chair Jensen, Representative Krupp, that report was mandated by Congress. The National Marine Fisheries Service was directed to work with the three West Coast states to develop that report and those recommendations, which they did in 97 and 98. With the support of Pacific States Marine Fishery Commission. The working group that got together to develop those recommendations tried to come to a kind of a center ground that we thought was defensible in the way of proposing management options to deal with the most severe or critical cases where seals and sea lions might be negatively affecting the recovery of a severely depressed salmonid stock. So we focused on specific sites and specific problems and specific stocks of fish that were in very poor shape. And we thought if anything can get through the system, this is something that we felt we could defend fairly well. So the consensus of the West Coast Working Group that developed that proposal, set of proposals, I would say that, and those that are still in this field at this point in time, I think probably still all agree that those are good suggestions and a good kind of middle ground way to go. I hope I answered your question.
No, you did. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
See no other questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
At this time, maybe I could call a couple of people up, Glenn Schoenbrink and Greg Addington. Glenn with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association and Greg with the Oregon Farm Bureau. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Glenn Stonebrink. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. In 1999 and again in 2001, I drafted a bill to do virtually this same thing. So the questions and the problems still exist if nothing happened out of those two bills. The first one did pass the legislature and was vetoed. Vetoed primarily because of the cost. It was not an amount allocated to the Department of Fish and Wildlife to do the study, to come back to this big question of optimum sustainable population. The next year, we did put a $300,000 price tag in the bill because that's the amount that was estimated by the Department of Fish and Wildlife to do the study. And it got delayed and eventually died at Ways and Means. So I'm glad that this bill is back. I'd like to suggest a couple things that that were a hang-up with this. One, of course, you mentioned was the cost, and it was alluded to by the Department of Fish and Wildlife, was the controversy, that this would just be a highly controversial issue if it were addressed to do something with the warm and fuzzy seals and sea lions. So the problem continues to exist, and we don't address it. And yet, as you know, we have the Oregon Plan that's come about, which stands between the governments of this on this issue of trying to restore fish, billions of dollars, and we really happened. And we pointed fingers at everyone else in the watersheds, the habitat, water quality as being the problem to restore the salmon. But we have to realize that that the salmon have made it through, they come from the habitats, they've made it through the dams, and they've made it down the river, and they've lived their 3 to 5 year life cycle in the ocean. And then when they're just about to come back for recreation or commercial or to go back and to their habitat and have more offspring, they're gobbled up in huge numbers. I mean, I heard talk back here, 30%. I have an old article from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service where they acknowledge 65% take. So it is still a huge problem. And I would definitely like to see this bill. It may need some amendments. I happen to believe that we're going to have to face music and say that there will have to be some lethal take before this problem can actually be addressed. I've suggested in the past that perhaps some Native American hunts, if they want, but something has to be done. I've also in the past suggested that the funds for doing the study for the optimum sustainable population should be allocated out of the OWEB funds, because that's one of the big main reasons that the voters voted for the infamous Measure 66 in the beginning, was to restore the salmon run. But the optimum sustainable population seems to be an elusive thing that's out there, that how do you count these benefits? How do you count them? And how do you determine if that's enough to be a sustainable population? So I've suggested a very non-scientific approach to that. And I don't know if it flies or not, but I'm going to throw it out again. But the optimum sustainable population would be that population that exists in the ocean from the coast outward. But when they get into the waters of the state, and that's where we tend to see the biggest take, is when the salmon start coming back and they congregate, and that's where the huge take is made. But once they get into the waters of the state, they are no longer part of that optimum sustainable population. And with that, I'd answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Very good.
Thank you, Chair Jensen, and members of the committee. I'm Greg Addington. I'm Associate Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau, and appreciate the opportunity to comment on House Bill 2516. I do not pretend to be an expert on this issue. I don't have quite the experience of my good colleague here with the issue either. But I think what I can share with you is a reason that this issue is very important to our membership. You know, for years, and Glenn has alluded to it as well, we've been told that our activities on the land have been a major contributor to the decline of the salmon population. We've been told in order to save the salmon that we have to improve our inland habitat, which is, as you pointed out, a place where they spend really a minority of their life cycle. The ag industry has evolved over the years and through a variety of efforts ranging from research and extension that has given us no-till seed drilling, riparian grazing management, to our involvement in the Oregon Plan and the Senate Bill 1010 process. The industry has made some tremendous strides. And the habitat, I think now if you were to visit a farms or ranches, the streams running through the countryside, I think you'd see that the conditions have never been better. I mean, the industry over the past century has made leaps and bounds, and yet we still see dramatic fluctuations in the number of returning salmon. You know, for at least the last decade or so, and probably much longer than that, the industry has been kind of saying, hey, let's look at the bigger picture, the ocean conditions and predation. As Representative Cruz pointed out, I mean, this again seems to be a situation where we protect one species at the expense of another. I think there's acknowledgement that this is a problem, predation on salmon. And so we certainly see this legislation as a step in the right direction, that maybe we can look at this if there's a way to work this out with the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and that the state can be more active and help us deal with the problem, then certainly it's something that our membership is very interested in and would support. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chair, could I have one more comment real quick?
Sure, go ahead.
I'm Glenn Sombring, for the record. I studied the 1999 report from the National Marine Fisheries Service at quite length in the past, and without saying exactly this, they virtually were begging the states to request management because they acknowledged throughout their report the huge take predation by the seals and sea lions. And so, you know, I think they would be ready if we just ask, I think, with a plan, of course, I understand that. But if we ask, I think they would be very happy to give the management to the state.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony today. At this point, let's ask Phil Donovan and Steve Byerlin. Is that correct? Is Phil?
He stepped out for a second.
Come on ahead, Steve. Kind of looked like maybe you were the one that was going to testify anyway. Is that the game plan?
Well, he had a few things to say. We hadn't really had a chance to talk it over, Mr. Chair, but I have some stories for you that relate to this. And Representative Jensen, I have been a guide, or I've actually been fishing on the Lower Rogue River for 35 years, been a guide for the last 18 years as a professional guide. I've watched the seal and sea lion problem develop as it's come along. I've never really been an advocate of going out and wholesale, you know, killing of seals and sea lions. I don't think anybody's an advocate of wiping them out. What we are is asking for protection of our fisheries, protection of our economies. You know, we have a fragile economy down in the Gold Beach on the Rogue that's based on fishing. I testified in front of the Natural Resource Committee a couple years ago. I know Representative Cruz was on the committee as to sea lion attacking an elderly couple in their late 70s in their boat. They use little car top boats down there. They fish long hours, lots of days sometimes to catch a fish. Brought the fish to the boat, had the fish in the net, which they couldn't stand up in their small boat. Due not only to the size of the boat, but their age. They both were in life jackets. The sea lion came into the boat after the fish, nearly capsized them. I went to the state police. went to the Fish and Wildlife, and finally I came to the legislature to ask that this animal be destroyed. I just got blank looks. It was a safety issue. It was going to happen to somebody else. These sea lions live a long time. They have a great memory. We have had attacks this last year on the Lower Rogue. Again, went to the Fish and Wildlife. Went to the state police, went to the county sheriff's department. They were all sympathetic. That problem was taken care of by a citizen. But I'd like to relate to you what happened in that situation, since it was with my clients and with me. There's a dock and a fish cleaning station in front of a restaurant on the Lower Rogue called the Rogue Landing. The windows face the water. And when we come in with our fish, we'll throw them up on the dock and, take them over to the fish cleaning station, and everybody oohs and ahs in the restaurant and waves, and we hold them up and show them to them, and they open the windows and yell, "How big is it?" and, so on. Well, this big sea lion, he's a very large California sea lion that we nicknamed Franz because he's so ugly, and there's a local resident down there that he resembles. Franz was in the area, and when we clean fish, the carcasses go down a pipe and into and they pick him up. Well, he must have been having a bad day or something, but it went on. But I was cleaning fish. I wasn't thinking too much about him. And we got the cleaning table, much like this desk, and I had the fish on top and filleting, and they actually have a wire structure to scale a fish that is off the side. And we had three fish laying there, spring salmon, and we were fortunate to do really well that day. And so we're all happy, and I'm cleaning fish, and my clients stand there watching the sea lion taking pictures of them, and the guests really like, watching the wildlife and stuff. So he's going around there and coming up under the dock and, doing it kind of like they do around the coast. And he jumps up on the dock, and he comes underneath the desk from this side. And I didn't see him, but I felt the dock, sink, and his nose and his mouth was right at my knees. I thought, well, that's, pretty interesting. I didn't get, I was a little bit alarmed, but not too alarmed, and I asked my folks to stand back away from the edge of the dock. And we had filleted the first fish. And okay, did you want me to hold for a second?
That's all right. Go ahead.
I had flayed the first fish and had not put it in the bag yet. We had a plastic clear bag. And my client opens the plastic clear bag and shakes it, so the air goes so we can drop the fillets in there. And he's standing back from the edge of the dock probably 5 feet. We've only got about 7 feet to work with. He's standing about 5 feet. And Franz comes from probably 50 feet away, rises up above the water, so he's about half body out of the water, and charges, jumps up on the dock, and grabs the bag. And so then I had my clients go back up on the walkway and get behind the railing. And while they're behind the railing, I went ahead and cleaned the rest of the fish. Before it was over, he had jumped up on the dock twice more, once pinning me against the railing with his teeth snapping at my knees. Now, I didn't have my knife on my hand, or I would have stabbed him in the nose, but if I had been armed, he would have been a dead sea lion, and that's, if nobody's going to take care of it, I'm wondering, is it going to get to the point that the sportsmen have to start packing weapons to protect themselves from the sea lions, and how good is that going to be? I have a great fear of shooting a sea lion myself because of the loss of my business and my guide license, and we are highly regulated. It was interesting a few years ago when I had brought this problem around. I actually went to National Marine Fisheries Service as the last resort and asked them, and the only ones that told me to shoot the sea lion was the National Marine Fisheries Service. I still couldn't do it because the state would have taken my license if I had gotten caught, But they wanted us to shoot it, And I said, well, you put that in writing. They said, no, it has to come from the agency, and then we'll put it in writing. But the agency wouldn't do that. So.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Phil.
Mr. Chair, my apologies for being outside of the room. Lobby days being what they are, I feel like I've got a number of balls being juggled right now. But I appreciate the opportunity to just quickly weigh in. There's no question that these animals are an important part of the ecosystem. However, there's a tremendous concern among anglers about the numbers of those animals, especially when we've had declining stocks of salmonids that we are now trying to delist. And not doing anything is very frustrating, especially as you heard from Steve here, when you see it daily. That's very frustrating. So having a plan, being able to articulate what that plan is an important aspect, and that's why the Oregon Guides and Packers Association endorses this measure. Appreciate the time of the committee.
Thank you. Any questions for Phil?
Could I make a quick comment, Representative Jensen?
Sure.
Getting into this story, after we were finished and moved away from the dock, we put a warning in the paper, put a warning on the radio, and there was about four other attacks afterwards, mostly with old guys. And I stood by the dock for some time, warning them, you know, when they got out of their boats of what the problem was, and the sea lion came after them also. You know, so.
Mr. Chair,
thank you.
It is
yes,
I.
Yes, Representative Flores.
I to me. It gets better all the time.
I don't think that is mental.
I'm just reminded, Mr. Chair, 2 years ago when Terry Thompson, who was then a previous legislator and now I think a county commissioner in Lincoln County, had told a story about a sea lion, and that was very similar to the story you tell. Do you remember that when a sea lion took a lady's small pet?
Oh my God. Attitudes change. At this time, if maybe we could call Sybil Ackerman and Stephen Confori, and is it Warren Aney? Mm-hmm. If you could all. Good morning. We'll start with Sybil, if we may.
Thank you, Representative Jensen, Chair. Appreciate the time this morning. And I am the Conservation Director. My name is Sybil Ackerman. I'm the Conservation Director at Audubon Society of Portland. Thank you very much for letting me talk today. I, of course, am not an expert on pinnipeds, and the main thing I wanted to do in reviewing this issue is make sure that folks knew that the Audubon Society of Portland is very supportive of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife's position on this issue. And as we've looked at some of these documents, I guess there's three main brief points I wanted to make, and then you have my testimony for more detail. The main questions that would be wonderful to have answered that ODFW actually did highlight already are the staff and resources question, that the costs of making sure that this program would work and work correctly. Also the question of the Stiller Sea Lion and those kind of protections. They've already been discussed today, but that would be another main point to consider. And then, of course, the overarching question of responsibility in terms of what are the main issues that are causing salmon decline. And just from looking and reviewing some of these documents and other things, we feel that this is one cause, but there are many, many causes. And so that's one thing that we just wanted to bring up, which is the overarching cause and issues around salmon decline. So the main take-home message that we have is that we are very supportive of Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife's position on this, and they are the experts on this issue, and you've already talked with them in detail, but that's just what we're here to say today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Sybil. Are there any questions? Yes, Representative.
Thank you. Sybil, good to see you again.
To say anything.
I'll just be brief, I promise.
Oh, no.
I might call it Representative Tomei and then.
Representative Krepp, it's so fun to see you again.
Your testimony talks about, in paragraph 2, about salmon are most at risk when slowed by shallow water and man-made obstructions, and I think we all agree with that, frankly. And not to put you on the spot, but I'm just curious. Do you, you're talking about shallow water, then are you in favor of deepening the channel at Columbia?
You know what's really interesting? You're asking me that. I'm going to do a little sidestep.
Okay.
Because actually, Audubon Society of Portland does not yet have a position on that issue. Although you can probably guess where we'd be leaning if we did have one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kafouri.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Kafouri. I'm here today representing the Wildlife Society Oregon chapter. The Wildlife Society is a national organization. It is a scientific society. It's not an advocacy organization like the Audubon Society is. We do not take positions on bills, either favoring or opposing them, but try to bring some wildlife biology to the legislature so that when you're making decisions, you can have the best available science. Our membership has employment backgrounds that are extraordinarily varied. A lot of them are hired by government agencies, ODF&W, federal or state agencies. We also have people that that work for timber companies, who work for utility companies or private consultants, because these days anybody who's a landowner needs to have a biologist either on staff or close at hand, and so we try to provide that expertise so people can do their business. When we make a statement, our statements are vetted through the organization, and we try and present as broad a viewpoint as we can among the scientific community so that we're not representing one narrow view or another narrow view. And we hope to be coming in front of your committee again and again this session, Mr. Chair, as you have issues that involve wildlife, and we will attempt not to repeat that little preamble too long, but just wanted to remind you of it. Thank you. And I'd like to introduce Warren Aney, who is a biologist and has a presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Forey. Mr. Aney.
Okay. Chairman Jensen, members of the committee, my name is Warren Aney, and I am a professionally certified senior wildlife ecologist with over 40 years' experience in my field, and I am here as Conservation Affairs Chair for the Oregon Chapter of the Wildlife Society. And as we understand House Bill 2516, it was to develop, directing Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to develop and implement a plan to control and reduce predation on salmonids through non-lethal methods. And I understand, we assume that you're specifying non-lethal methods because of the Federal Marine Mammal Act, which does not allow lethal take of pinnipeds except in cases of immediate threats to human safety. The proposed legislation raises some issues that we'd like to have you consider. And, of course, and this has been mentioned before, the primary issue is the one of cost. In order to undertake a new planning and action program, new funding and staff would have to be provided. The current Department of Fish and Wildlife funding for marine mammal research and management comes primarily from the National Marine Fisheries Service and with some state general fund monies for data analysis and sampling design. The personnel that are currently employed with this funding cannot be redirected without eliminating this ongoing research, and we feel this ongoing research is important to support any action plan that would be taken with regards to management of pinnipeds. Also, effective non-lethal methods of control are not currently known, and we are not aware of any ongoing work to design and develop such methods. From past experience with many kinds of wildlife depredation, we found that non-lethal methods by themselves generally do not work. You have to combine it with some modicum of lethal methods to give the animals the idea that you really mean business. Would be a little value to write a plan that the experts know will have little success. There's been allusion to mention of the 1999 report that was put together by Washington, Oregon, California, and the National Marine Fisheries Service and others, and it had three primary recommendations as we understand them. It would allow the states and federal agencies to take California sea lions and Pacific harbor seals, but no other species, under specific conditions. And these conditions were in situations where listed or candidate fish species are in jeopardy in specific areas and where immediate relief is necessary. Lethal take would be allowed under certain circumstances. And in specific situations where non-lethal means have proven effective or feasible, lethal take would be allowed. And in situations involving a fishery or marinas and non-lethal methods have proven ineffective, lethal removal would be an option. And this is currently has been reported to Congress, and Congress has not yet taken action to address these recommendations. So we don't have any, at least in the foreseeable or in the near future, any relief for the Marine Mammal Act restrictions in this regard. But we've also mentioned the problem of the Stellar or Northern Sea Lion, which is found in breeds in Oregon and is federally listed as threatened, so it cannot be harassed or harmed. And this would have implications for any management actions that Oregon proposes, particularly in the Rogue and the Columbia River estuaries where this species is sometimes found. Also, it is very difficult to document cause and effect relationships between these two. You have two highly mobile groups. You have the fish on one hand and the marine mammals or pinniped predators on the other hand. And it's very, even if we knew the non-lethal methods today, we could probably would not be able to relate changes in salmonid runs to the application of these marine mammal deterrents, except when you have a really artificial situation like Lake Washington. There are many factors limiting salmonid recovery, and these may vary with each watershed. Any potential pinniped management should be conducted in the context of addressing all the limiting factors for salmon recovery within that watershed. And, of course, now we have a situation where salmon and steelhead numbers have been up significantly. I think it makes it even more difficult for scientists and resource managers to establish a recent case for pinniped control. Thank you for our perspective. It will allow us to present our perspective on this bill, and we're available if further information is needed.
Representative Carl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Non-lethal means of controlling animals, you mentioned that we're unaware of any, and the thought popped into my mind, for some of these really problematic sea lions, pinnipeds that maybe hang around the docks like was described earlier, we have shock collars for dogs and and perimeters established. Have we ever thought about anything like that? I know it's a bit bizarre, but it probably was. Pardon?
It's very bizarre.
I mean, you could theoretically we tranquilize animals and move them as a part of management. Could you tranquilize an animal and insert in the skin one of these shock things and then put a perimeter? I'm just, being wild here about this. I guess.
It might work for friends. I'm not sure.
Okay. Representative.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out that line 6, section 1, where it states the plan shall include all feasible and prudent alternatives, that would allow us to go to lethal. So, but the thought was that we need to try to be as humane as possible in this. We do know that non-lethal methods really don't work, and so that allows us to get there. But clearly, that needs to be the first thing that's tried. For example, if a sea lion is relatively new to the area, moving him, he may not come back, or he may. If he continues to come back, then there'd have to be a take. But if moving him eliminates problem, then that would clearly be the preferred alternative. But Section 1 does allow in the plan for take if it's required, as I read the as I read the bill.
Just
clarification.
Any other comments on? Were there any other people who were signed up or who want to testify on this particular bill? Seeing none, thank you all for your...
Mr. Chair, if I can make a couple additional comments, and I appreciate the hearing on this session as we did last. The work done by ODF&W and National Marine Fisheries Service probably arrived at the proper and prudent method of dealing with this issue. But the problem still remains, the fact that to expect Congress to act on it in this century is problematic. And I know we just started this century, but Congress has an aversion to getting into these sorts of things for some reason. So knowing that's not a viable alternative in the short term, I think for the state of Oregon to step out front and try to get an agreement with the federal government to allow some alternatives is prudent. And you know, the reality of it is, if you don't ask the question, you can't get an answer. And that's basically what we're doing. And clearly this would have to fit in the book of business of the department for the next biennium. I cannot see, because most of the we don't need to research this anymore. We have the research. Basically what we need to do is develop the plan and offer it and see if it's accepted. So I don't see where we got to hire a whole bunch more scientists or anything like that. The research has been done. It's just we got to ask. And clearly that's what this bill would be intended to do. It would be to have the ODF&W ask.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Krupp.
Thank you. I also might make comment that based on what we've heard here today and this issue, that I think there would be some rational and reasonable thought given to accessing OWEB funds to pay for any programmatic changes in ODF&W should we adopt this policy. And I might also say it does disturb me that there may be circumstances where guides and their individuals at docs in some very extreme cases should have the authority to protect themselves from potential life safety issues. I know that's probably very rare, but it does disturb me that there are these circumstances that have been recorded, and there is a fear that they cannot do anything because they may lose their license.
Representative, I appreciate that great minds work in the same channel, because I just passed Representative Cruz a memo or a note to the effect of the same issue. But, I share your concern very much with that a guy would fear for his loss of his license if he had to shoot an animal that was threatening the life, his life, or the life of one of his clients.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes absolutely no sense in the world to me.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it still gets into the same question and the same. I mean, it's still the same issue, and the same question needs to be asked of Commerce. So I agree, and I'm willing to consider that in this. Probably a combination of that into this as far as what we're asking for an exemption for.
Lieutenant Shoffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When I go backpacking, I carry a sidearm with me just in case there's a wild animal. And I'm not going to hesitate to use it. I'd rather kill a beautiful animal than be its lunch. I have to agree. If that gentleman had a sidearm on him and he felt endangered or someone was at risk, I don't think he should lose his license either. Now, I don't want open season on pinnipeds, and I don't think anybody up here does either. But yeah, that did surprise me. But as far as Representative Krupp's suggestion that we all got a good laugh out of, you know, I got to say, that's the kind of thinking we need to do, because if you can't kill them and it doesn't do any good to remove them, well, here we are. And if the federal government isn't going to do anything, I think we do need to look for, as unusual as it may sound, alternatives to do it, whatever it meant. And maybe that is it. I mean, if it's just a small number of animals, maybe inserting something in them that irritates them when they get within a certain parameter.
Is this
maybe
kind of a methadone approach?
Okay, I'll go with that.
Ms. Chair, I think maybe we could solve the problem by having Representative Shoffler backpack on the coast. And
okay, enough frivolity beyond this. We're going to close. I beg your pardon. I'm not going to close it for a minute. We have a couple of.
This goes into the next one.
Oh, Okay. We're going to close the public hearing on our pinniped friend and move on this public hearing on 2516 and move on to our next agenda. And you introduce that for us, if you would, Mr. Tess.
House Bill 2376 abolishes the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, transfers its duties, functions, and powers to the State Department of Agriculture and State Department of Fish and Wildlife. It declares emergency and will be effective upon passing. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, thank you. And we have a fairly lengthy group of people testifying on this. And if I could, let's bring them up in panels. We'll start out with Mr. Stonebrink from the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. And Hal, is it?
Sal Wasser.
If you would, please, from Oregon State University.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Glenn Stonebrink with the Oregon Cattlemen Association. And I would indicate off the bat that I know there is a similar bill to this in the Senate, and Representative Cruz and Senator Beyer have had some conferences on this bill, and there probably will, between the two bills, there will be some compromise and amendments. And I understand that. And so I want to talk then to the basics of this concept. We have to face the reality that there's a big difference in what the government does as far as the wants and needs. Up until the budget crunch, there were a lot of wants that were funded. And they were nice programs, but I think we're in a mode now where we have to sift these things through a sieve and determine what is a need and what is a want. The OWET, or Measure 66, which then was passed by the people said this is something that is necessary. Of course, OWET then was created by this body. But it is duplicative, let's face it. There are a number of areas in which we need to look at cutting costs of government, redirecting funds that, I know we don't, didn't like to use the word backfill, but in the I think all things, all bets are off as far as what we used to do, what we need to do, and when we look at some of the programs that are pretty dear to the Cattlemen Association, this is dealing with 1010 and the confined animal feeding operations, such things as getting funding for science, true science, so that that we can get the actual facts of cases and what's happening on the ground. Some of these monies need to be directed in those areas. I think it's incumbent upon this body to take a stronger oversight into that and making that happen. What I see here is, and was discussed in Senator Beyer's bill, was the need to get a more involved player with these Measure 66 funds, and that's the Soil and Water Conservation District. I have in my past, I worked with the U.S. Department of Agriculture under what's now known as the Farm Service Agency, very close connection with NRCS and the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, which we often call the SWCDs. I know how they function. I know their efficiency. I know they work. One thing that we must always remember, that if we're going to have money spent by the government to enhance habitat, that habitat almost entirely, we're talking about habitat on private property.
So we have to have private property owners being cooperators. They are used to dealing with the SWCD. There's a big element here that I think that can never be overlooked, and that's trust. And that's why I think that because the farmers, the ranchers, the other landowners understand the SWCDs. They're very helpful. They get solutions on the ground. They make things happen in a cooperative manner. And I would like to see this bill, of course, with some modifications, I'm sure, between the two bills, pass, get these funds directed at the soil and water conservation districts. We're going to get more results quicker. And the bottom line is, it's going to save money. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Stonebridge?
I have a question. Hi, Glenn. Thanks for coming this morning. Glenn, how much money have the ranchers received from OWEB for installing fences? That's one of the things that OWEB provides funds for, as I recall.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I don't know the answer to that, but I want to make a little comment on that. That's directly from OWEB. But I do know that through a cooperative effort at each county, that you have the federal government there with extension, partly funded with extension. You have the NRCS, you have the FSA, and then you have OWEB. You have these different pools or avenues of funding for landowners to do things like fencing, mm-hmm. if it's necessary to fence cattle away from mm-hmm. stream or to do better cattle mm-hmm. grazing management. And that is the place that our people go to. Is they walk in the door, the first thing they want to do is go to the SWCD, and they'll say, here's what I want to do, how do I do it? And they walk them through. They can show them where the technical assistance is available. They show them where the funding, the cost shares are available. And I say cost shares because it's not a free program. It's the rancher puts up a portion, usually 50%, sometimes less, but usually that amount. I don't have the exact figures, but I think OWEB is here, and perhaps they could answer that.
Great. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair. Glenn, any idea about how much money it would save if this concept were to be adopted and OWEB's functions were to be divided up amongst other agencies? You got any sense of how much money that really would save?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I have not. I only heard what was said in the Senate committee. That's why I would encourage that this bill could get to Ways and Means so we could get some fiscal and revenue numbers on that. I don't have, because there will be a difference of opinions. I've had phone calls, one last night from someone who works for a watershed council that believed that they were going to lose their job, and this bill doesn't say that. But they were saying it would just cost more to recreate the wheel than what we are already doing. Well, I don't know that. I don't know that yet. I don't believe that in my heart, but I can't prove it until we can get some figures from as it gets through Ways and Means, as it gets to Ways and Means.
Thank you.
Okay. Hal?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Hal Salwasser. I'm Dean of the College of Forestry and Director of Oregon Forest Research Laboratory. Interim Director of the Institute for Natural Resources at Oregon State University. I'm also a forester and a wildlife ecologist with more than 30 years of experience in state and federal agencies and academia, the last dozen of which as a senior executive. It is my professional judgment that the proposal to abolish Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board and transfer some responsibilities to the State Department of Agriculture and others to the Department of Fish and Wildlife is not in the best interests of Oregon. OWEB is playing a critical and vital role in implementing the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watersheds, and this plan is a unique and successful model for state-led species conservation. This past summer, the Institute asked Dr. Kosh Arha to take on a review of the Oregon Plan as part of thinking about what to do with the Oregon Plan as the transition to a new governor and new legislature occurred. And what Dr. Arha, working with myself and Gail Ackerman, found was that the Oregon Plan is
clearly and convincingly stimulating interagency action and volunteer private sector activities that had not been heretofore occurring. These activities have begun to reverse the historic declines of salmon and steelhead and begin to improve the health of watersheds that are so critical to their life cycles. It is true there are other agencies that could be that are working to implement the plan, and but those agencies represent primary interests that are narrower than the Oregon Plan and OEB are addressing. And these agencies are outstanding organizations, agriculture and fish and wildlife, but they do not have the ability to provide the coordinated oversight to all of the different agencies that OEB does. This Oregon Plan report that I've provided for your inspection shows that Oregon is pioneering a governance model in interagency public-private partnerships for species conservation that could become a valuable augmentation to the top-down command and control regulatory approach that other states are living with. The costs of not going forward with this model that we are still perfecting here in Oregon can be seen in our neighboring states that do not have a strategy such as the Oregon Plan. It's our view that OEB is critical to making the plan work and keeping Oregon in the vanguard of business, government, and volunteer collaboration. This on-the-ground implementation and mitigation programs through landowner applications that are facilitated through OEB's programs are key in making progress that will continue to allow Oregon to play a lead role in managing species conservation rather than having that management dictated to us solely by federal agencies. I'd be pleased to take any questions you may have.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimonies. And those who are, we'll bring Jim Myron up at this point from the governor's office. And colleagues, if you look at the clock, and we have yet to testify on this, something in the neighborhood of a dozen folks. So, I'll ask you to maybe keep our questions short and maybe to hold them till we get to the next session on this, or perhaps and ask the people who are testifying to consider the time element and try to be as brief as possible, especially for those who have given testimony on the Senate side. That at least some, if not most, of the members of this committee have monitored those testimonies, so you might be able to summarize maybe a little on that. Thank you. Jim, with that, if you would, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Jim Myron with the Governor's Office, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here, and you have my written testimony. I won't go through that, but let me just comment on something that came up during the Senate committee hearing last Friday. Senator Beyer mentioned that to him this is really an issue of agency coordination and consolidation and potentially improving the delivery of government services to the public. If that's the case, then the governor would be willing to support the discussion of a consolidation effort for all natural resources agencies. Rather than picking a little piece like this and trying to do something like this, the governor would prefer to see a broader discussion of state agency coordination and consolidation, potentially leading to the discussion of a natural resources agency, where all of the existing natural resource agencies would become parts of a larger agency. There's some natural, it seems to me there's some natural ways that some of these agencies could come together. For instance, you know, one water agency with DEQ and water resources, one land agency with maybe forestry and ag and Division of State Lands, DLCD, a wildlife and recreation agency with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, Marine Board, parks, that kind of a discussion. So if there's a way to maybe step back a little bit and look at the broader issues and have a discussion of that, and maybe we don't have time during the session to complete that, but at least that would be the governor's office suggestion on this idea. Thank you.
Who was it that was looking for an interim committee assignment?
Well. No, Mr. Chair, we gave you water law for your interim work.
Navigability?
Yeah, well, if I could, Mr. Chair, jump.
Yes.
It's an interesting concept. Be willing to discuss that.
Well, and it may actually save some money as well as improving state services.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would compliment Jim and the governor's office for being willing to consider those types of ideas. Do you feel that there may be some duplication of effort that we could potentially bring more efficiencies to by perhaps some consolidation of programs?
Representative Krupp, we haven't taken a real close look at it. I know that that folks like Gail Ackerman have spent a lot of time over the years thinking about this issue, so what I would suggest is that we bring her into any discussion of this sort, because she brings a lot of thought to that process. But, yeah, there could be.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. The chair, too, is intrigued with the idea that you're bringing to us from the governor's office, Jim, and would like to pursue those discussions with the governor's office about how we might start to look into that. I know Representative Cruz works with one of those consolidations of agencies and has spent a lot of time and energy, so he would be obviously a valuable resource from the legislature on that.
And, Mr. Chair, I guess I would have not presumed to take so bold a step, but it's certainly, it's certainly worth discussing.
Mm-hmm. We'll look forward to the discussions.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
At this time, if I could have Phil Donovan, Ray Wilkerson, excuse me, and Hillary Abrams, Phil Donovan with Northwest Fishing Industry, Ray with the Oregon Forest Industry Council, and Hillary with the Nature Conservancy. And we'd start off in order here with Mr. Donovan and Mr. Wilkerson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association, and here to express some concerns about proposed legislation to dissolve the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. You know, over the course of our state's history, we've made numerous attempts at trying to maintain healthy populations of salmon and steelhead. The primary causes of our lack of success can be traced to two points. First off, untested and incorrect assumptions about what will work in maintaining those populations. A good example of that is the idea in the past of clearing large woody debris out of streams, which had the effect of sterilizing them. Also, an inability to maintain continuity over a period of time so that we could learn from those efforts. OWEB was designed to institutionalize the integrated nature of the Oregon plan, where all natural resource agencies were partners and no one agency was or had a dominant role. This made for broad support from a broad range of stakeholders. To shift this role in the ways that the Senate bill has proposed, potentially with this legislation, threatens to take some of those agencies out of the funding picture. Right now, everybody has a seat at the table, and that's a good thing, and like I said, has led us to having this broad support. Not only is it helpful for the idea of the funding mechanisms, but also the monitoring and evaluation aspects of the Oregon plan. Are we seeing success for the investments that we are making? We feel that OWEB has a good track record of this, and frankly, we need to give it the opportunity to be successful. We strongly support the Department of Fish and Wildlife's role, and we strongly support how the current director, Director Lindsey Ball, has stepped forward and said, we are going to be an agency providing leadership on the Oregon plan. That's appropriate, and it can be done within the structure of OWEB. Appreciate the opportunity to address the committee.
Thank you. Chair, if I could just make one point. Getting back to the removal of woody debris, that was a requirement by the federal government at that point in time, and clearly the folks who were doing it thought it was stupid, but they had no choice. But I would say, in all due respect to Mr. Donovan, that the main reason that we have not been more successful over time in conservation activities is we never had the money, pure and simple. The one thing that's happened is we now have money, and I would also submit that any structure that's now in place or that was in place before, properly funded, would still be getting the same sorts of results.
Okay, Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Ray Wilkerson with the Oregon Forest Industries Council, and I will be brief. And we also have concerns about this legislation, not so much for what it might do as to how it would be perceived by the outside world if we were to enact legislation like this. And I think the best way to briefly explain that is to look back and remember the real reason why the Oregon Plan was established in the first place, which was to avoid the direct application of the Federal Endangered Species Act on the salmon issues that we faced in Oregon and are continuing to face. And we all collectively in this building, the governor, the legislature, both sides of the aisle, all the interest groups came together and agreed that was a good idea, that to have an alternative to that federal kind of command and control approach. And then a subsequent legislature agreed that that was important enough that it deserved its own administrative entity that existed solely for the purpose of making sure this alternative to the federal ESA could succeed. This legislation now, you know, questions the judgment of that decision by a previous legislature, and looks at maybe consolidating the functions of the Oregon Plan into other existing state agencies. Again, I think I can't state with absolute certainty that the plan couldn't function and be efficiently administered another way. But I think that keeping in mind again the purpose of the Oregon Plan initially, which was as an alternative to the federal ESA application, I think that purpose is more important and frankly more promising right now in terms of what's best for this state than ever. Just recently, the state of Oregon made a formal request to the federal government to formally recognize the Oregon Plan as an alternative to the federal ESA application, and I think this current federal administration is inclined to look upon that request favorably, and if we could achieve that, that would be a significant benefit for a whole lot of reasons, legal reasons, just the autonomy and sovereignty of the state of Oregon, and would allow us to continue what has become a model of a state conservation plan. So the conclusion would be that if the legislature does something that appears to be backsliding or backing away from its commitment to the Oregon Plan, or the people of Oregon may not be as committed as they were, it would be more difficult to get that federal formal recognition, and that's the reason we have concerns with this bill. Thank you,
Greg.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Any quick question from?
Just a comment for the record, and I appreciate Ray's testimony. And there's nothing in this legislation or the legislation of Senator Beyer, and I can speak for him on this, that's intended in any way to minimize or the efforts we are making in salmon recovery. That's not the intention at all. It's unfortunate the way the bills were drafted. the summary statement of the bill doesn't really speak to what's intended here. So, that's just the way LC works. So,
thank you. I think Representative Krieger has joined us here, and I believe you'd like to come up to the dais, if you would.
I don't want to sit
in Mary's lap. we'll let them.
It would look bad on camera, wouldn't it?
I'd love to see it, though.
You will not. You will not get that on camera. Thank you, Chair Jensen, committee members. For the record, my name is Wayne Craig. I'm a district rep from District 1. I would suspect I'm probably the only person in the legislature that has spent time as an OWEB member. 5 years when I was on the Board of Forestry, I was the delegate from the board that sat there. And I did leave OWEB, and we did a lot of things that I felt were good. And it was a growing period for the group and the people that took place and the watershed councils that were being developed. And I think it had a lot of positive effect. But I did have some concerns, and I have talked about those concerns with the Director Huntington on a couple occasions. And we've had some good dialogue regarding that. The makeup of the councils, where they're slowly going underneath OWEB as far as the watershed councils, gives me some concern. The fact that they're not all sponsored by a government entity, such as the County Commission or Soil and Water Conservation District, I think needs to be corrected. They've become a little bit too independent, and that's caused some problems in my mind. The fact that they don't actually all do annual reports, and that there's a lack of accountability. And these are some of the things that are causing people to look upon OWEB and the Watershed Council, and I link them together because they really are as maybe not being what we intended to be, and that is starting to drift away from the original purpose. The one thing the Watershed Councils and OWEB did is they gave access to private property at a time when some of the other state agencies, such as DEQ, LCDC, Department of Fish and Wildlife, were not held in high esteem by property owners, and you couldn't even get on their property. That mindset changed. They did bring that around. They brought people to the table that would have never got there, and that was very important, I felt, underneath the Oregon plan. The grassroots idea, going back to the makeup of the watershed councils, I think we need to make sure that that is kept in mind. And Mr. Wilkins' testimony regarding the fact that trying to get the 4D exemption that both our governors are trying to do this, to me, is focal. This is not the right time to play games with this agency, even if we don't mean that we're trying to dissolve it, change it. It could be make an appearance to certain type of people that this weakens the Oregon Plan for Recovery of Salmon. If we do need to do something with this agency over time, I think we need to maybe get a group together to look at what the shortcomings are, see if it can be fixed. If it can't, fine. And I would go back to Mr. Myron's discussion. That might be a better look, a much broader look at all the natural resource agencies and duplication and what we might do there to make it better for Oregon. That's all I have right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative, and appreciate your coming in to share with us your background in this and your views on it. Are there any questions for Representative Krieger? Thank you very kindly.
Thank you.
Sorry for the interruption, Hillary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Hillary Abraham. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Nature Conservancy of Oregon, and I agree with many of the comments that have been made so far, so I'll do my best to be brief. The mission of the Conservancy is to preserve the plants, animals, and natural communities representing the diversity of life on Earth by protecting the lands and waters they need to survive. And we have some concerns about this bill as well. OWEB has fulfilled its mandate to create specific tools to engage and empower watershed councils, conservation districts, and other local groups to conduct scientific assessments and surveys and to plan, prepare, and undertake complex restoration projects. It has developed protocols for prioritizing projects and monitoring results to judge their effectiveness. These tools put everyone on a level playing field and are essential to the scientific credibility and fairness that the voters who passed Measure 66 have a right to expect from a statewide grant-making body. And a record of effectiveness also helps keep the Oregon Plan on point in the eyes of federal agencies and other observers. OWEB is fulfilling the intent of Measure 66 by making funding available to local projects in every county and watershed across our state and in leveraging additional dollars from private and public sources, including federal programs. The enabling legislation created an OWEB board structure that is critical to the implementation of the Oregon Plan. It includes representatives of all the state resource agencies, as well as tribes and leading Oregon citizens and business people. It includes non-voting representatives from the federal resource agencies to ensure they are consulted and engaged in Oregon's unique approach and in its results. The legislature created this board as a statewide granting authority to be neither beholden to or dominated by any one state agency, and its credibility hinges on this independence. In our view, then, the OWEB board and staff have done an outstanding job of fulfilling the expectations and directions set for it by the legislature and the sponsors of Measure 66. No other state agency is in a position to pick up this mantle. If OWEB and its board were abolished, the result would be a tragic loss to Oregonians of an effective, solutions-oriented program that is making a difference in every corner of our state and returning a sense of ownership and stewardship to local communities. In summary, the Conservancy strongly urges the legislature to keep faith with the voters who passed Measure 66, and as the legislature did in 1999 and in 2001. The stakes for Oregon future remain extremely high, even as we navigate uncharted budget waters. Thank you very much for your time, and I welcome any questions you might have.
Thank you, Hillary. Any questions? Thank you. I appreciate your testimony, and we'll look forward to seeing you again on probably the same bill.
Thank you, Representative.
At this point, we have Rick Allison and Tom Wolf, please. And again, if I could emphasize, we're obviously up against the clock. If you could be as brief as you can, we'd appreciate it. Rick Allison first.
Morning. I'm a forestry technician and natural resource manager down in Lane County. Our family's fifth-generation Oregonians residing on a 250-acre working ranch and tree farm in the Poodle Creek Valley, which is a tributary to the Upper Long Tom River, just west of Eugene. My father is a former Grange Master, director of Lane, Mid-Lane Soil Conservation District, and a member of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. He first introduced me to the Long Tom Watershed Council more than 4 years ago. He recognized the value of a non-regulatory organization that inspired effective stewardship and personal responsibility. At 76, he just keeps getting smarter. I currently chair a steering committee for the Long Tom Watershed Council, and I'm proud of how much we've accomplished so far. We have a valuable watershed assessment. We collect water quality monitoring data that we publish and share with various agencies and municipalities, including DEQ, Corps of Engineers, ODF&W, and the cities of Bonita, Monroe, and Eugene. We have a lot of projects on the ground, and I think we're out there promoting the kind of community contact that it takes to really get the job done. We're successfully, I think, in large part because of OWEB. We receive current scientific information, technical oversight, and responsible grant funding, administration oversight, and I just want to let you know that in my personal and professional opinion, I think the Watershed Council model is really working. I currently sit on a local advisory committee that drafted the Upper Willamette Agricultural Water Quality Management Area Plan as part of Senate Bill 1010. As mandated, it mandated at Oregon Department of Ag, as mandated of Oregon Department of Agriculture. I was really impressed with Stephanie Page of Oregon Department of Agriculture and Dave Downing of East Lane Soil Conservation and Water District. I've experienced and utilized SWCD stewardship projects, most specifically their forest improvement projects. Gary Galovich of ODF&W has been a valuable asset to the Long Tom Watershed Council in the form of technical review and advice. He professionally helped our family, I know, fast-track a permit application for an in-stream restoration project. The point I want to make here is that the current system's working. The Watershed Councils and OWEB are working due to the non-regulatory inclusive approach with this broad scope that includes urban areas. ODA and SWCDs are very good at where they are traditionally the strongest, and that's with agriculture and forestry. Senate Bill 1010 is even going to extend their responsibilities. ODF&W provides valuable technical support and regulatory oversight. We all are pulling in the same direction. Seeking a single restoration product delivery system can only narrow the scope of public outreach. It's kind of like telling General Motors that the answer to success is offering only one model of Chevrolet. If there's one thing that my dad has lived by all his life and still lives by, and that is that if it's not broken, don't try to fix it. Please don't knock a wheel off the Oregon planned vehicle that's picking up speed and heading for the checkered flag. I urge you to consider against House Bill 2376, and I apologize for all the automobile analogies, but it was a long drive this morning. So.
The point is well taken. Thank you very much for making the long drive. I appreciate also the comments about the growing wisdom of your father as I approach those years much too rapidly. I'm glad that there's something to look forward to.
Well, we've noticed that in you, Mr. Chair, over the years, the growth in wisdom. So.
Oh. Any questions? Tom.
Chair Jensen, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, and I come here on a dual purpose as a chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, a cold water conservation group, and also as the chair of the Tualatin River Watershed Council. I've handed out my comments, so I'm not going to read them. For brevity, I will just make a couple key points. I don't believe that by eliminating OWEB and transferring duties, you're going to save any money. B, when I heard all this talk of transferring duties, nowhere did I hear of an agency that's equipped to deal with urban streams. We have many watershed councils that deal with urban streams, and they're a special... They're much different than rural watershed councils, and they have special problems. And OWEB has specifically done a lot of work to deal with those streams, and I don't believe by farming off to either Department of Ag or to ODFW that you'll be able to handle the problems of urban streams. C, you'll be sending the wrong message to watershed councils. No matter how you frame it, they're going to look at the fact that the state has abandoned them. And speaking for a bunch of really concerned members of the Tualatin Watershed Council that frankly feel that that the state will abandon them. It is a wrong message to send at this time. And lastly, I believe that having worked with OWEB and seen what they've done, I believe that OWEB, the watershed councils, have done a good job. I believe that we still have a long ways to go, and obviously we're not finished. But to eliminate OWEB, for whatever reasons, is the wrong thing to do right now, and both the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, the Tualatin Watershed Council, and myself stand bitterly opposed to that. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Tom? Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate your testimony and appreciate the long drive you made. Jerry Hinsbach, I got that correct, and Bruce Taylor. Jerry? Would you go ahead?
I'm chairman of the Pudding River Watershed Council, and I've tried to contact Representative Cruz to find out what's going on here. I mean, it's like I just kind of live out here in the valley. I'm a farmer. I own timber. I've got businesses. And
Jerry?
Yes.
For the record, we need your name.
Jerry Hinsbach.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
And I've listened to what's been said. My council's got a little bit split on it. We had an executive board meeting, and Timber basically felt that they didn't too much care what was done with OWEB. They didn't really like it being split up in two different agencies. I personally have been involved with this watershed council since before its inception. I work with Mary Pyramine, Marion County Commissioner, to get this thing going, and we work with the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, and we've partnered up with just about everybody that we can get our hands on. And we're doing a pretty good job. We're just kind of working along. What concerns me about this probably the most was probably expressed with this representative from District 1. I can't remember his name here, but I didn't write it down. Pardon me?
Representative Krieger.
Representative Krieger. Thank you very much. I like the idea of fixing OWEB. I've encountered OWEB by going to some meetings. OWEB sends a representative to our meeting. Soil and Water Conservation does. City of Salem, Marion County. We don't get people from Fish and Wildlife. We don't get people from the Department of Ag. They don't come to our meetings. They don't interface with us at all. For us to function as a watershed council, our most important thing to us is that we have a coordinator with and some office funding. And with that funding, we're able to do things. The things that we do are down on the ground level. We've been able with just... It took us 2 years to even start getting money. We don't even have a full year under our belt with a coordinator. We have a coordinator. We have an AmeriCorps person. But we put together, we have a school program going. We have a monitoring program going. We partnered up with Marion County. We partnered up with the Archbishop's office and the Governor's Oregon Solutions team, sent representatives to us. We get a lot of help from everybody. I don't really get any resistance from anybody. We work with DEQ. Everybody works with us very well. I'm a little bit concerned about getting back to digress a little bit because I didn't write anything down, but this thing of fixing OWEB, yeah, I do see some problems there, and every time I run into them, I always throw some comments out there of things that I think that they could probably do better, and I hope that over time that they will probably take my suggestion. Personally, dealing down at the watershed level, down at the grassroots level, the funding that comes down to us is fine. We're doing great with it. Most of the people on the council that work with us and the other people, other citizens that come in, they kind of like that OWEB thing, the Watershed Enhancement Board, the fact that Ed Gallagher from the Oregon Solutions team basically was Kitts Harbor's idea to get support down to us so that the people that I work with could see that the government was doing something for them. You know, minimal amounts of money that we get. I mean, it's like we get less than 50 grand. We're not even spending all the money that they gave us. We just spend it on what stuff we need. And some of the money's going to go back at the end of our biennium. I'm very concerned about that. A lot of the people on our council, probably half the people on our council, are there because of the image, because of what they do and what they feel that they're doing. I think, personally myself, I'm with that group. I mean, I'm just there. If we get split up into two different agencies, Fish and Wildlife, Department of Ag, then what becomes of our agenda? You know, it's like even OWEB right now is talking about cutting back on the money that they can do for our coordinator. Without a coordinator, it's really hard for us to do anything. That means it goes back to me, who for a year before we had a coordinator, I worked 30 hours a week. I mean, I'm kind of semi-retired. I have businesses and farming and timber that I do, but I'm a dog with a bone, and I just kind of got on this thing, and I've just been working at it, and I put together the school program, got the all the agencies come in. I work with my coordinator almost on a daily basis, just trying to move this thing along and get it going, and I'm really concerned about my structure, and it is my structure because that's what I do on my watershed council. This is my baby. I work myself up to being chairman. They let me do just about whatever it is that I want to do. I'm worried about my structure falling apart because of an image problem, you know, and I don't understand why. I really don't understand. I've tried to this is the only time I can get to talk to you. I'll be back here on the 11th. I think I told my watershed council coordinator to set me up with appointments with everybody who's opposed or everybody who's in favor of this thing. I want to talk to them. I want to find out why we can't do this thing down here at the grassroots level. I mean, it's like you realize how much the money that you give us, how many hours that it leverages. I mean, how much work gets done, real work. I mean, I've got school districts, Mount Angel School District. This spring, we cleaned up, for the last 2 years, we've cleaned up every river road crossing. I've bought in crews. We partnered with Marion County. We've cleaned up sites on the Pudding River that nobody could clean up. And I don't get resistance from property owners, businesses, governments, or nobody resists what we're doing because we're doing the right thing. And I'm worried about this image problem. I understand there's a budget problem, but that's not my problem. That's a problem that you have to solve in funding this state, and to try and do it on something that's so volunteer oriented. And Fish and Wildlife, I own property. I've tried to do fish recovery stuff where they come out. Every time an agency comes out to me, they come out with a stack of papers of stuff that I have to do and fill out and hoops that I have to jump through so that I can do something. So most of the time I just kind of let that go by. Well, this and this organization and with Watershed Councilmen right now, I feel that I'm making a difference and I'm doing a good thing. And I just want to let you know that.
Well, thank you, Terry. We really appreciate your testimony and your coming today. And it certainly is because of people like yourself across the state of Oregon and their commitment and concern that we've been able to make some strides in this area. And with that, go to Bruce Taylor, the Defenders of Wildlife.
Thank you very much, Chair Jensen, members of the committee. I'm here today on behalf of Defenders of Wildlife to oppose House Bill 2376. Defenders of Wildlife was one of the original proponents about Measure 66, and we have devoted a lot of time and effort to monitoring the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board to see how they manage that investment program that that constitutional amendment set up. I've attended every one of the OWEB board meetings since they started, and most of the GWEB, the old Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board meetings, in those 2 years or so before the ballot measure 66 was enacted. It occurs to me maybe it's hostage syndrome, you know, where the hostage comes to eventually admire for perverse reasons their captors. But I really have concluded the current members of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board are some of the most thoughtful and capable citizens in state government today. This is a very effective board with strong leadership, good working relationships, and a genuine interest in the health and future of Oregon's natural resources and the communities they support. The executive director, Jeff Huntington, has earned high marks from his board and outside observers alike for his work in helping to develop the new agency. Although the process has not been without its bumps, it is in many respects a remarkable achievement. OWEB was built on the run, a brand new agency with mostly new board members dropped into the middle of an ongoing grants program with a dramatically expanded mission and financial resources, much higher expectations, and more intense public scrutiny. Today we have a very sophisticated board and a highly professional staff administering a conservation investment program with a scope and scale that is unprecedented in Oregon's history. The results will not be fully realized for years, perhaps even decades, but the initial returns are encouraging. Good projects are being done on the ground. Short-term ecological benefits are already apparent, and independent studies have documented the significant economic benefits to rural Oregon. Perhaps more important, the Oregon approach to habitat conservation and watershed restoration appears to have firmly taken hold in communities across the state. Unfortunately, the effectiveness of the Measure 66 investment program has been seriously compromised in recent years. General fund support for implementation of the Oregon plan has largely been eliminated, replaced with almost complete dependence on Measure 66 lottery revenues and federal funds. Most of the non-capital portion of the Measure 66 money available to OWEB has been used to backfill holes in existing state agency programs. We still have substantial Measure 66 funding available for capital investments and on-the-ground work to protect and restore natural systems. But most of the non-capital funds intended to support that capital investment program for education and outreach, watershed council coordination, assessment and planning, monitoring of results, most of that's been lost. House Bill 2376 would further undermine the intent and effectiveness of Measure 66. One of OWEB's strengths has been its status as an independent agency with a clear purpose and well-developed mechanisms for public accountability. House Bill 2376 would eliminate that independent entity and fragment implementation of the Oregon Plan and the Measure 66 investment program, parceling out OWEB's responsibilities among two agencies that are already ill-equipped to handle their traditional roles. OWEB is currently managing an investment program that is directing more than $30 million per year into long-term enhancement of Oregon's natural resources. Dismantling OWEB will only almost certainly result in a more fragmented, less strategic, and less effective investment of those funds. OWEB is not perfect, but it is not broken, and House Bill 2376 will not fix it. We hope you will set this issue aside and let the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board move ahead with the job the legislature gave it only 4 years ago. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. And at this point, I would like to offer into the record the written material you have from the Native Fish Society and from Intergovernment Relations City of Eugene. As part of the official record on the testimony that we have, that we are hearing on this bill. We have Jeff Huntington, and I believe Jeff will make himself available at the next meeting, next public hearing meeting we have on this. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to do whatever helps.
I think we're pushing our envelope of time, and we certainly have depleted a little our resources on the dais up here. So with your permission, Jeff, we'll hold anything you have to say until our next meeting on this bill. Thank you. Okay. Interesting idea the governor has. Oh, I beg your pardon. I got to bang this gavel and close the hearing before.